Welcome to this event recorded for the National Academy for State Health Policy's Telehealth Affinity Group, a cross-state, cross-agency group of state health officials and policymakers interested in advancing evidence-informed policy in the area of telehealth. This project is sponsored by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCORI, for the purpose of enabling effective dissemination of patient-centered outcomes research on telehealth. My name is Christina Kusart. I am a senior policy associate with the National Academy for State Health Policy, and today I am here speaking with Dr. Robin Liu, a family and preventive medicine physician currently practicing with Kaiser Permanente in Portland, Oregon. Previously, Dr. Liu worked with the Center for Evidence-Based Policy at Oregon Health and Science University, where she focused on helping state policymakers interpret and apply clinical evidence. Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Liu.
Thank you, Christina. It's my pleasure.
With the continuing spread of COVID-19, we recognize this is an especially unique moment for policymakers and others to delve into telehealth research and the many ways telehealth tools can be used to provide services to patients at a distance or in their own homes. Today, we are focusing on two recent studies, both focused on use of telehealth tools to treat and manage patient care post-hospitalizations. Dr. Liu, please tell us more about this work.
Thank you. So the two studies that we are going to dive into today, both, as you said, relate to post-hospital care and improving patient outcomes, both clinically and in quality of life. The first study is entitled Using Home Coaching to Support Older Adults with Chronic Illness After an Emergency Room Visit. This falls under what I would consider transitions of care research, where you have patients who are at a high risk both of poor health outcomes and of high healthcare resource utilization. These patients are at risk by virtue of a number of things. They are elderly. All of them have at least one chronic health condition. Most of them have more than one chronic health condition. All of them have, at some point, made the decision to come into the emergency room due to some health concern that caused them not to feel that they could manage themselves at home. And all of them are, as I said, at risk both of having poor health outcomes as well as of having to come back to the hospital and use more healthcare resources. So this study was aimed at this particular population with the outcomes of interest being patient-reported quality of life, number of recurrent emergency department or hospital visits, and number of visits to their regular doctor. The intervention that was tested in this study was coaching that was delivered by the Area Agencies on Aging, which are organizations that provide resources to elderly and disabled individuals with the goal of allowing them to remain in their homes and communities as long as possible. A little bit more about the population of this study. This was conducted in Florida, in the United States, and in two separate emergency department facilities. Total number of 1,322 patients were enrolled. They were 48% Black, 48% White, and 4% of a different race. And the average age of the patient enrolled was 72 years. Patients were randomized to the intervention, which again was a coaching, versus control, which was usual care from emergency department staff. A little bit more about the intervention itself. The intervention was designed in such a way that the coach would meet with the patient in person within 24 to 72 hours after the person was discharged from the emergency department, and then again up to 3 times by telephone within the next 30 days. So it was designed to be a 30-day coaching intervention with 1 in-person touch and up to 3 phone appointments. The coaches delivered services such as helping patients to schedule their doctor's follow-up appointments, helping the patients to identify and respond to signs of worsening health, reviewed with the patients their instructions for taking their medicines, and having goals of care discussions with their providers, and then some more practical support such as arranging for rides or meals, etc. The patients enrolled in the usual care group received the usual discharge instructions from emergency department staff, which could have included verbal and written instructions regarding taking medications, symptoms to watch out for, and ways to manage them, as well as the importance of follow-up with their usual doctors. So in the results of this study, there was no difference found in the primary outcomes, which again were quality of life, number of return emergency department visits, and number of follow-up visits in their regular doctor's office. All patients had similar outcomes in these three measures. The one finding that was different between groups was that patients who were in the coaching intervention group, when they did return to the emergency department, they were less likely to be admitted to the hospital from the emergency department and more likely to be discharged home again. However, it's not clear to me whether this was a pre-established outcome of interest or whether this was kind of a post hoc analysis. It seemed that a lot of secondary outcomes were evaluated after the three primary outcomes found no difference. One of the major limitations to this study is that only 60% of the patients who were enrolled in the intervention group actually completed a meeting with their coach. And so there were obviously logistical or other acceptability problems with having the coach come into the patient's home and complete this intervention. There was some feedback from patients in the report in which patients felt that the coaching actually may have increased their self-reported anxiety and that it may also have increased patient sensitization to their health status and caused them to use more healthcare resources than they might otherwise have. So that's our first study. The second study that we're going to look at today. And I will just note the first study, the final published report is not available. We have the summary and the abstract, but not the full report. So I don't have a lot more detail than that. The second study actually is available in full published report form, and it's entitled, Can Coping Skills Training Help Patients Who Have Received Intensive Hospital Care to Cope with Depression and Anxiety? So the authors of this study note that in the United States, about 1 million persons annually receive ventilator support in an intensive care unit, and that, as has been previously noted, these patients are at high risk of mental health adverse outcomes, such as depression, anxiety, and PTSD. This intervention was designed to deliver via telehealth psychological care that was aimed at reducing those symptoms and improving patient quality of life. This was a multi-center randomized controlled trial in which the intervention was a telehealth delivered psychology intervention, weekly phone calls with a psychologist, and patients in the control group received written and online information about the causes and treatments of their illnesses. Patient self-efficacy and knowledge about their illness has been previously associated with poor mental health outcomes in ICU patients, and so it was thought that this education intervention giving patients knowledge about their illness might be an effective control group for this coping skills training group. So the population, as I said, was enrolled from four different studies in the United States: Duke University, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, University of Washington, and University of Pittsburgh. They eventually were able to enroll 175 ICU patients. And each patient was offered the option to bring along with them up to one family member who would also be participating in the intervention. And so in addition to those 175 patients, there were also 86 family members who were mostly parents and spouses of the patients. The average age of the patient in these cohorts was 52 years. And again, the patients were randomly assigned either to the telehealth psychology versus an education online intervention. The outcomes were symptoms of depression and anxiety as measured by something called the HADS score. That's the Hospital Anxiety and Depression Scale. This HADS score was measured within 2 weeks of hospital discharge, so pre-intervention, then again 3 months post-randomization or immediately after the intervention, and then again 6 months post-randomization. The intervention I will discuss a little bit more in detail for the first group. They received a 30-minute phone call once a week for 6 weeks with a psychologist, and they were trained in that phone call in certain established and validated coping skills techniques to help them deal with symptoms of anxiety and depression. Patients also received some online and internet resources and access to a study website that had resources about these coping skills. The second group did not get phone calls from a psychologist. They did get two phone calls from study staff to make sure that they were able to access these informational videos and materials, again, educating them about their illness process and treatment. So the result of this study was, again, that neither intervention resulted in improved symptoms overall, except in the patients with the highest or most severe distress scores at baseline. So for the patients whose HADS score were greater than 14, and higher score means more depression, maximum score on the scale is 42. So for patients whose scores at baseline were more than 14, there was a statistically significant difference in their scale at the 6 month follow-up time if they were in the coping skills training group versus the control group. The limitation of this study again had to do with loss to follow-up. The study authors enrolled, I believe, 40% more patients than they thought they needed because of expected attrition of patients who were severely ill from the ICU. And the attrition still was higher even than they anticipated. And so a lot of the subjects died before the study was complete, or their illness became severe enough that they could no longer participate. And so these two studies, as I said, both deal with post-hospitalization, both deal with quality of life and mental health, both deal with a telephonically delivered training. Both unfortunately failed to show statistically significant results in the outcomes they were measuring, but I think there are still some things to learn from these. So, Christina, if you want to kind of introduce the next section.
Thank you for that overview, Dr. Liu. And just noting that these studies were completed a few years ago in 2018 and 2017, respectively. And we are in a slightly new time right now, given the COVID-19 pandemic. So I'm wondering if you could share a little more about what you see, given this environment, as some of the potential policy implications or impacts of this research.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the new environment in which we find ourselves, where patients and providers both had to become suddenly more comfortable with telehealth overnight. At least in my own practice, I know that we switched from 100% in-person care to almost 100% virtual care, literally over a weekend, and patients actually who might not have been accepting of that type of care in the past were suddenly more comfortable with it than of coming into the office. That said, I think the lesson from a lot of these studies that we have looked at in this affinity group is that you have to be very careful with what you bring into a patient's home when you are trying to deliver care remotely. We've seen this in previous calls as well, where having something, some monitoring system or some person coming into the patient's home to deliver care is actually anxiety provoking and can have a negative impact on the patient's quality of life. And I think that it is all the more important to have patient stakeholder input in the design of these interventions and to consider the impact on the patient's quality of life over and above, and or not above, but necessarily, but balancing the impact on the management of their disease state as you're looking at these types of interventions. The other thing I would say is that targeting these interventions is also seemingly pretty important. They don't seem to always work for the general population. And this was something that was a deliberate choice by the authors, particularly of the second study, the ICU study. Previous researchers that have looked at ICU populations really have focused on the sickest or the most distressed individuals to target interventions to people who are most likely to get a benefit. And these authors really did choose to target a general ICU population, and that probably impacted their result in terms of not finding much benefit between the two interventions because they really did include all comers, including patients whose baseline distress scores on discharge from the ICU were quite low. So I think stakeholder input in designing interventions, concern for what you are bringing into a person's home and what you're asking of the person in terms of their day-to-day life, and also targeting the patients who are most likely to benefit from these interventions are all sort of important key messages that come from all of the studies that we've looked at so far.
You mentioned for both studies, one of the challenges was attrition of patients throughout the study. Do you have any thoughts on strategies that could be used to help either mitigate those issues or improve attrition rates in future work?
That is tough. I think that the two studies probably have some of the same and some different reasons for the attrition rate. Certainly, in the second study, the patient's degree of illness and disability from their illness had a large role in whether they were able to complete these follow-ups and these weekly psychology phone calls. In the first study, it's less clear what was the reason for the patients not following up with their coaches. Again, this was an intervention that was designed to be delivered within 24 to 72 hours of leaving the emergency department. So presumably the patients can't have gone far, but for whatever reason, whether that was because the coach was unable to reach them or unable to contact them, or because the patient changed their mind and decided not to allow this person into their home, or maybe they agreed to the study while they were in the ER, but then once they got home, they decided that wasn't really necessary. It's unclear. Again, the final report's not known, so it's unclear what the reason for the attrition there is. But I think reinforcing what I said before, which is that the interventions in their design phase really do need to consider the patient perspective and really do need to get a broad range and a diversity of voices in the room as these interventions are being designed so that when they are delivered, they have the best chance of being accepted and completed by the patients.
Thank you. What could you see as other barriers to effective implementation of some of the research you've described today?
I think that a lot of the logistical types of barriers that we would think about in telehealth are, as I said, this is something that's kind of changed overnight with the coronavirus pandemic, is where previously we had barriers to payment or barriers to technology. A lot of provider offices and patients are figuring this out very quickly, whereas previously it was thought, oh, this is going to take some time to implement. I think there have been some leaps made in that regard. But I think that is still a big challenge because patients who are the most vulnerable and the most ill and the most in need of these kinds of reaching out and touches from the healthcare system to prevent further worse problems down the line are patients who are also most likely not to have internet access or not to have reliable telephone access or to have other social barriers to allowing this kind of care into their homes. And so, as I talk about being patient-centered, those may be the voices that are hardest to get into the room as you're designing your interventions. And then the patients who are the sickest and sort of the highest yield for these types of intervention may also be the ones who are hardest to reach.
Thank you. Another theme that has come up quite often in our discussions with this affinity group, and I think is underscored here a little bit, again, is this trade-off of wanting to rapidly develop new solutions or answers and use of telehealth tools and evolving technology to address pressing healthcare needs. But there is the trade-off of needing some time to conduct this research and, as you're saying, be thoughtful about the ways we're implementing technology and various tools. So can you talk a little bit about that trade-off, and given wanting some rapid deployment of new changes, what do you think are some of the most important lessons to draw from this work?
I think that the most important thing that I would say about that particular concern is that we need to understand in healthcare policy that we aren't working in a vacuum, and we aren't necessarily reinventing the wheel every time, that there are other agencies or other departments of government or social service agencies that have similar challenges in how to reach these high-risk populations and who have already done some work in this area. And so I think that if you are trying to both collect input from these hard-to-reach populations and also reach out to them, and sort of, as you said, rapidly deploy these kinds of technologies and novel delivery methods, really integrating with other agencies and other departments that are also delivering services to the same population is just, its importance can't be overstated.
I respect that. I do agree that that would be quite critical. What more would you say might be needed for policymakers or other leaders in the field to be able to take action on some of these initiatives?
I think that as PCORI is looking at what types of research to fund, you know, we have some good preliminary data, and a lot of the studies that we've looked at in this series of conversations have not had significant findings in their results and have been, you know, in that sense, we can't point to this and say, well, this is what works. But we already have some information about how those studies were done and what they tried and what maybe was the limitations, and maybe post hoc analyses or subgroup analyses that may point us in the next direction. And so I think continuing to take this research that we have, look at what the study limitations are, and also maybe at how, what kinds of hypotheses are generated by this research to point us in the future direction for what populations to target and how really to utilize stakeholder voices to design these interventions, I think is going to be important going forward. And as you said at the very beginning, it's a different world now. And so just always keeping in mind how the impact of a global pandemic changes or doesn't change these types of needs and the acceptability of these types of interventions is also going to be really important.
You mentioned there taking some of the lessons from this research to help point us in a future direction. Do you have thoughts on what that direction might be or where we might be heading?
Well, I think I've said most of it is that really what's very clear is that the current healthcare system delivery model doesn't reach the people that it needs to reach in the most effective way. And when we say, okay, well, bringing you into the office for a face-to-face fee-for-service type visit doesn't necessarily meet your needs. Let's go into your home. Let's give you a internet-connected monitor that will, you know, collect your vital signs every day. And the patients say, whoa, I don't want to be monitored in my home. That, you know, we really have a challenge there to engage this population and to really listen to what is important to them and what is important to them in management of their health, and try to not just charge forward, well, this is what we've got, this is what we can use, so let's give it to you, but to let the patients guide us in saying, well, what do you really need and what would really be helpful to you?
Thank you. Are there any other important takeaways you think researchers or policymakers should be drawing from these studies?
From these particular studies, I would say, you know, don't give up yet. I know that it can be discouraging when we come call after call and say, well, this one didn't show any benefit, or this one didn't show any benefit, or we tried this and we didn't get anywhere. That telehealth really is here to stay in some form or fashion, and reaching people where they are continues to be really an important goal in delivering healthcare. And so working with all of the different, as I said, different departments, with the providers, helping, doctors can be really hard to convince to change, to do things differently. And so I think this is a really teachable moment. And I think that we, as I said, we know some things from these studies, like, for example, that if we're going to target post-ICU depression, we should probably target the most depressed people first. And if we are going to talk about bringing coaches into people's homes, we should probably make sure that that's okay with the people first, and maybe try to see if there's some other way that we can deliver the same services or the services that the patients need to stay healthy, in a way that's acceptable.
Any last thoughts on these studies you'd like to share?
I don't think I have anything additional. This has been a really fun conversation.
Great. Well, thank you. Appreciate your time so much today, Dr. Liu.
Thank you, Christina.